From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. Later on, what in the world are they spraying? Michael Murphy joins us, but here's what's happening. The flooding Mississippi River is causing great turmoil in the South and Midwest as floodwaters now are rising to historic levels. The Coast Guard has closed off shipping on the river that had been bound for the port city of Natchez, Mississippi, saying that the weight of the barges could put further pressure on the levees there. The river is a key route for moving grain from Midwestern farms to the Gulf of Mexico, so the closure could have a major impact on commerce if it lasts more than a few days. It is costing about $300 million a day. Two towns in the state of Massachusetts are moving to ban sales of a relaxation brownie called Lazy Cakes, laced with melatonin and sold in food markets after children who ate them required hospitalization. The mellowing chocolate treats, which sell for $3 to $5 at food stores and some nightclubs, are legal, but contain nearly 8 milligrams of this supplemental sleep aid, which is about 25 times the usual amount prescribed for adults. Shades of Silence of the Lambs. Russian police say they've detained a man who was caught eating a friend's liver. Police tracked down the suspect after a trail of severed body parts, including limbs and a head, were found across Moscow. When the police came to arrest the suspect, he was eating a human liver with potatoes, according to a police spokesperson. There is no word on the rest of the friend's body. The next big question on the federal debt limit could be whether to start selling the government's holdings of gold at Fort Knox. And at least one presidential contender, Ron Paul, says he thinks it would be a good move. The question has been bouncing around the policy circles today. An analyst at the Heritage Foundation says that the gold holdings of the government are just sort of sitting there. And he added that given the high price it is now and the tremendous debt problem we now have, maybe we should sell it at its peak. They think it would garner $370 billion. Here's registered investment advisor Mish Shedlock. Mish, what do you think? Sell all the gold in Fort Knox?
No, I don't think we should do that. Certainly not to pay down the federal debt. I read this article twice, and you know there are so many things in it that just don't ring true. Ron Paul wants a 100% gold-backed dollar. So how can you have a 100% gold-backed dollar and sell gold? I think one of two things. I think the New York Sun is either confusing Ron Paul with Ron Ut. They interviewed two Rons here, I guess. The second thing is that Ron Paul might have made a statement, you know, possibly about selling gold coins or something, and the Sun translated that into selling gold to pay down debt. Those are two completely different things, so I think that story is false. I think we're going to see a retraction or some corrections or something on it tomorrow. It just does not ring true, George.
Mish, do we even know if there's any more gold in Fort Knox?
Well, Ron Paul certainly has an issue there with that, and he wants an audit of Fort Knox. We've not done one for something like 50 years or something. So, you know, I think we should audit the Fed. I think we should audit Fort Knox. You know, why don't we have an accounting? So on that issue, I certainly agree with Ron Paul.
Talked to a soldier a long time ago, said he was issued a gun there, a weapon. He was part of the group guarding Fort Knox. He said they never gave him any bullets for it. That's kind of strange, isn't it?
Well, it is. But you hear those stories. I mean, there's probably like billions of layers of security here. By the time you get into that last room, you know, if someone's gotten through that far, is one bullet going to be enough? I don't know. There's some interesting things, if you've got a second here, going on in Spain. You know, everyone's focusing on Greece and, you know, looking at all this stuff. But protests are starting in Spain. And, you know, if the Spanish economy blows, if the stock market starts believing, excuse me, the bond market starts believing that Spain can't pay back its debt, you know, this is like 10 or 20 times the magnitude of what Greece. And I think Spain's going to blow. It's just a question of when.
How's it affect us? What do you think?
It affects the European banks more. And what I'm trying to figure out is whether or not the Fed would step in and try and support those. We did it once already, and there were a lot of protests, and people were howling when we saw, you know, that we lent that money to those foreign banks. Would we do it again with all the eyes on it? I don't know. I think we see a lot of foreign banks go down.
All right, Mish, thank you. An Egyptian princess who lived 3,500 years ago was thought to be the first known person to have developed heart disease. Doctors believe the princess would have needed a heart bypass if she were living now. Scans show that she had extensive blockages in arteries leading to her heart, brain, stomach, and legs. Here's our reporter, author, researcher, Christian Wild with us. You would think she would have eaten well, Christian.
Well, I certainly think so, George. Dr. Gregory Thompson at the University of California commented on the story. He said her diet was significantly healthier than ours. She would have eaten fruits and vegetables, and fish was plentiful in the Nile at that time. He explained the food would have been organic, there'd be no trans fats or tobacco available, and yet she had these blockages. According to the doctor, he said, this suggests to us that there's something, a risk factor for heart disease that causes this that we don't yet know enough about. Well, some of us sure think we know. Dr. Paul Ridker from Harvard, Dr. Robert Superco, Berkeley Heart Labs, Dr. Jig Patel from Cedars, Dr. Carol Watson from UCLA, and John Rubmerger from Princeton have been studying it and preaching it and teaching it for many, many years. George, in the mid-90s, something called inflammation was being considered as a major contributing factor in heart disease. And it was not all a case of cholesterol, as you and I have talked about so many times. So from 1996 all the way back to the time these mummies, and no one knows the role inflammatory factors played in heart disease, during the past half century in America, when someone contracted an infection like a bacterial infection, they'd be treated with antibiotics, which would neutralize the infection and rid it from our bodies. However, a person like this Egyptian princess, who incidentally died at 40 years of age, in today's story, would not even know she had an infection. And without treatment, the disease would continue to fester and inflame and calcify the arteries for the rest of her life.
You would think she would have eaten turmeric as well. I guess not.
I don't think they had it in Egypt. She could have got it from India or China or from your medicine cabinet, no doubt. But when scientists in Johannesburg, South Africa, discovered a 2.5 million-year-old skeleton in a cave, they determined that the skeleton's disease had not been from the result of trauma, but from an acute inflammatory lingering process. So that adds some credence to this.
Interesting.
In the inflammatory syndrome. So that's the reason the subtitle for Hidden Causes of Heart Attack and Stroke, George, which you have so graciously highlighted on Coast to Coast, is Inflammation, Cardiology's New Frontier. It's why I keep hoping that all the Nuriites will ask their physicians to check their inflammatory markers.
Let's hope. Christian, thanks. His website, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Not to worry, the Egyptian princess will not be in my medicine cabinet. No mummy going to be there. A teenager has astounded tutors by learning to play complex piano pieces in just a few hours, despite being unable to read music. 19-year-old Samuel Osmond of the United Kingdom has never had a piano lesson, but can pick up pieces by composers such as Chopin and Beethoven in minutes because of his note-perfect memory. He started playing 2 years ago, and was the first piece he played was what you just heard, Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven. That was not him playing. That was somebody else, but that's what he does. Up next, Andrew Bashago joins us. We're going to talk about time travel, DARPA's automated video surveillance. This is a split show, and Andrew is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Andrew Bashago, a lawyer in Washington State, leader of the Project Pegasus program. Andrew is waging a campaign to urge the government to disclose the time travel technologies that he says have been kept secret for more than 40 years and deploy them globally on a socially responsible basis to advantage of humanity in the 21st century. Here's Andrew back on Coast to Coast. Lots to talk about. Andrew, how are you?
Excellent, George.
Good
to hear your marvelous voice again. Good to be with you.
Give us a little update about Project Pegasus for those who don't know what that program is.
Project Pegasus was a federal research project of the United States government under DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, that was launched sometime in the mid-1960s. It began gearing up in the late 60s, and by the early 1970s, it was already involving a cadre of American school children and adults in time travel using the different forms of quantum access technology that were fully operational by 1970.
Okay. Now, what has been going on lately with DARPA? What are they up to?
Well, I think we have to account for the fact that, you know, science reporting in this country is really perpetuating the time travel cover-up. Essentially, it's complicit with DARPA in doing so. Every time something in this area is announced, just recently, in early May, DARPA announced that it had created a technology that can index and analyze video in real time. And the thrust of the articles that covered this development was that this would mark the end of public anonymity. In other words, the ability of people to remain somewhat private when they're out in the public. My problem with this kind of article is that it really purports to present to the public the state of the art in this kind of time travel technology, namely the ability to use remote viewing technology to put people under observation. In fact, DARPA had far surpassed the performance of this kind of technology 40 years ago when I was a child serving on Project Pegasus.
40
years
ago?
Every time something comes out in this area, we're getting a little piece of the picture. We're being prepared, ultimately, for the revelation, I think, of the existence of Chronovision all these years, but we're getting only half the picture.
Can we ever get the full picture on this, Andrew?
Well, if my truth campaign succeeds, we will. You know, I've tried to describe the state of the art in remote viewing technology and in teleportation that DARPA had achieved by 1970. It went far beyond facial recognition systems and using computer programs to view video that was taken in real time. In fact, by 1970, DARPA had developed chronovisors that capture vivid images of an individual doing something in a past or future event.
In a past or future event?
Correct. And so the issue isn't that, you know, DARPA can put a video camera in Times Square or park a truck outside your bedroom and determine what's going on in Times Square or in your private life. It's able to capture the signal of an event on a non-local basis. So DARPA has been able for four decades now to capture images of what might have happened in Times Square or your bedroom 5 years ago, or what will happen there 5 years from now. And that kind of technology presents a much greater risk to human privacy than simply the loss of public anonymity that sophisticated real-time video surveillance will work.
Andrew, how was this technology developed? Who developed it?
The chronovisor resulted from an accidental discovery. That's one of the amazing things about the provenance of that particular quantum access technology. Two Vatican musicologists, Pellegrino Ernetti and Pier Maria Gemelli, were working at the Catholic University of Milan in the 1940s, studying the harmonic patterns in Gregorian chants. And they were developing a specialized microphone to split the signals of the voices in the Gregorian chants. And they made a modification to the microphone, and to their astonishment, something that Father Gemelli's father had said to him in childhood came through the microphone, and they realized that they had made literally a quantum discovery, basically the ability, the capacity to identify the signal of a past event at that time and amplify it and bring it into the laboratory.
That's astounding. Now, what did they tap into? Did they even know?
I think they tapped into the residual signal of all events and even the incipient signal, you know, the residual signal of past events and the incipient signal of future events as they exist in the quantum hologram. Because if there wasn't this kind of permanence to events, events wouldn't be able to happen. The signal would have nothing to ground on. It would just tumble through time-space as an unrooted event. So if we think of chaos theory and the fact that there's essentially a constant recapitulation of an event occurring at smaller and smaller levels of magnitude after the event occurs, they found a way to capture that signal and amplify it.
In time, who developed it further?
Well, I believe that they then partnered with the great Italian physicist Enrico Fermi. That's indicated in the literature. By 1952, Father Gemelli was claiming that as a result of working with Fermi, they had reduced this accidental discovery to a device, namely a device not unlike a rudimentary television set that possessed a flat screen upon which you could view initially past events occurring. And so I think Fermi is probably the father of time travel. You know, I think he really played the role that's been attributed to a variety of researchers, including Nikola Tesla. Certainly John von Neumann's name appears in the Montauk literature. And even Wernher von Braun is believed to have consulted some of these early time travel scientists.
At this point, were they able to develop a system where they could pinpoint exactly when and where they wanted to go forward or backward, or was it just, you know, catch as catch all?
Well, if the chronovisor device is not being attuned, it essentially moves randomly through different points in time space. But we know that even with that initial device, Ernetti and Gemelli were able to identify the time space coordinate, because by 1952 they were tuning in the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth. And Father Ernetti, who was a distinguished Catholic prelate, Gemelli, of course, would see the largest Catholic hospital in Rome named after him. But Ernetti, as the principal researcher, maintained until the time of his death in 1994 that they were able to literally tune in the time of Christ and recover remote images of his crucifixion. So, yes, they were able to tune in a specific point in the time-space continuum.
We know that since we began broadcasting radio and television transmissions, that they're being beamed out into space. And, you know, there's an ability to capture that into, you know, because that's why we're sending them out, for example. That's one of the things SETI was doing while it was still operating, was sending signals out into space. So we've always thought about extraterrestrials, Andrew, picking up these signals for many, many, many years ago. I mean, we've always thought about that. What you're saying, though, that with this chronovisor, they've got the ability to capture events that are non-broadcasting, but to go back into time or in the future that are somehow out there in the ether somewhere.
Absolutely. In fact, as Father Ernetti said, every individual from birth to death traces an arc in the quantum hologram of light and sound. Everything that has happened, is happening now, or will happen is stored somewhere in the quantum hologram. The challenge is to find it and capture the signal of it and amplify it. And that, in fact, is what Project Pegasus achieved.
Are they piercing another dimension? Are they tapping into a multiverse? What are they doing?
Well, that's one of the limitations of chronovision. They found that, in fact, when they were capturing these signals, some of them were from timelines that are not the timeline that we're on. And so they were tuning in events and realizing, well, wait a minute, these are alternate realities.
Now, are these audio events that they're picking up, or are they also getting video pictures at that time?
Right. Let me describe the first image I saw on a device like this. That
okay.
Was more like
and you were a youngster then, weren't you?
Correct. I was brought in officially into Project Pegasus in the fall of 1969 as I was transitioning from age 7 to 8. I was September born. That was the beginning of the third grade for me. So I was one of the child participants.
All right.
They were bringing gifted and talented students into these Cold War research programs. And the first image of a past event that I saw on a TV-like screen, it was more like a kinescope. It wasn't black and white. It was more shades of gray and green.
Not tremendously clear?
Actually, it was crystal clear. And germane to your question, in fact, I could not only see what was going on, but I could hear what was going on. And the event was the signing of the U.S. Constitution in Philadelphia on September 17th of 1787. So by the early 1970s, now I saw that at the at a national security watch post in Flemington, New Jersey, where the technicians were retrieving and recording past events filming them on 16 millimeter film stock and basically storing them in canisters and then forwarding them to somewhere else in the government.
So you're telling me, Andrew, that we have the capability to go back into time, that you even saw it, you witnessed seeing the signing of the Declaration of Independence?
Correct. I didn't see it as if looking through a window as it was occurring. I saw a hologram in which that event was recapitulated in dull colors and clearly in sound. I could see that some of the framers, I could hear when they moved their chair or coughed or got up and left the room.
Let's talk more about what DARPA is going to do with this when we come back. Well, we've got a split show for you tonight. Andrew Bashago, our special guest for a couple hours, will take phone calls with him next hour. Later on tonight, Michael Murphy joins us with his work, What in the World Are They Spraying? We'll be back with Andrew in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Andrew Bashago, our guest. Andrew, these chronovisors, how do they work?
Well, when I entered the program in the late 1960s, clearly the rudimentary chronovisor that Ernetti and Gemelli had developed had been evolved. I remember my late father, Raymond Bashago, who was one of the project principals, stated that the Vatican had approached the United States government about taking the technology further. So when I entered the program officially in the fall of 1969, the chronovisor had already been developed into a device that generates a hologram of a past or future event. And as it was explained to me, that was done by driving an electromagnetic signal through an octagonal, that is an eight-sided array of bismuth crystals. This produced a hologram of light particles so dense that the device had a lensing effect, whereby timelines that are adjacent to our own are brought into the laboratory. And so you had this cubical hologram being generated on a stage-like device with a crystal array in the ceiling. In fact, a crystal array so bright that we went through a training exercise to avoid looking up at it, because if we did, we would be rendered blind.
Jeez.
So this was an intense light that was being generated, and an extremely dense hologram. It produced an array and a depth of color that I've never seen in a motion picture, for example. Now, in front of the stage, there was a control panel, but what was most conspicuous was that there were two boom operators who were moving forward and back, and also up and down, directing some form of particles across the hologram. In other words, they were operating booms that were emitting some kind of stream of particles by which they could fix the time and space coordinate of the hologram.
Well, they were like sprinkling them down on them like snowflakes? Or
No, these were devices that looked almost like studio television cameras. I couldn't see what they were directing at the hologram, but it was explained to me that they were emitting something that allowed them to generate not just a random concatenation of, let's say, images from different past events, but literally tune in the time-space coordinate of what the hologram was imaging, let's say the signing of the Constitution. So, for example, when those operators stepped down from their boom devices, the hologram just started randomly moving between alternate scenes, just basically a chaos of quickly changing scenes from different periods of time.
And probably some might not have been all historical. They could have just been events from a certain era.
Oh no, and this goes to the sanctity, in fact, of our private lives. I'm alleging that DARPA has this technology. In fact, since the days of Project Pegasus, when they were generating holograms, it's probably been digitized into a turnkey surveillance system, such as is depicted in the feature film Deja Vu, because now we have computer technology to quickly bring up images, still photographs, and also moving images on our computer consoles.
Mm-hmm.
So then in the laboratory, when they were first experimenting with chronovision, they clearly wanted to generate holograms so that you could get a better look at what was going on. But if you stood inside the hologram, you actually experienced being in that past event. But yes, many of the things that I witnessed, in fact, many of the events that I visited inside the hologram were absolutely mundane moments in time. But those moments are sacred. They make up our lives, and I think that the American public deserves to know that this has been done with their tax dollars, and that the remote surveillance technology that DARPA has developed goes far beyond just filming people on the street and using a computer to go through and make sense of the images and determine who's a terrorist or whatever. It, in fact, involves the ability to invade the sanctity of everybody's past and future.
What would the purpose be to do this?
Well, maybe it hasn't been done. But if we look at the fact that really since 9/11, we've seen the emergence of a police state in this country, my concern is that because the U.S. government is secretly in possession of this technology, if we took an even further turn for the worse in terms of the government tyranny that we've seen, we would all find ourselves living in a 24-hour surveillance state, at least potentially.
And
then
we...
there are all the complications of things like criminal law enforcement, as was depicted in the film Minority Report. Would we actually develop a Bureau of Pre-Crimes if we knew someone was destined to commit a crime in the future? These are some of the philosophical complications. But I'm most concerned about the impact of this technology on our privacy.
Would we even be aware that we were being spied on or checked on?
No. No, the technology does this absolutely non-locally and without any apparent signal in the environment.
What about the future now? Let's talk about that. What, as far as you know, where have they gone? What have they seen?
Well, I was actually a direct participant when they were trying to use Chronovision to capture images from the future, and they had a specific research purpose. We were trained utilizing essentially a time spacesuit, not unlike a spacesuit, a NASA spacesuit, that was coated with titanium. And we also participated in some exercises in perception, in how to quickly, for example, look to the left and right and make sense of something very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Because on November 5th of 1971, they brought about eight of us up to the ITT Defense Communications Building in Nutley, New Jersey, which then and now is immediately adjacent to the Defense Logistics Agency, which does the mapping of future threats for the U.S. military. And at that location, there was a much larger chronovisor. The stage was larger, the crystal array above us, the intensity of the hologram that it generated, hence the need for the protective suits. And that was the first attempt to use chronovision to go forward in time and image an event that could then be made sense of in terms of human perception and cognition.
Was it easier to go back in time as opposed to forward?
It was in the sense that it had first been developed as a device that produced images of past events.
Okay.
I guess the benefit or the technical complication there is that we have the residual signal of a past event that's cascading through the time-space continuum forever. But in the case of a future event, they clearly had to make a modification, an advancement, to capture the incipient potential of a future event, which they ultimately achieved. Because what we saw when they turned that light on, and I remember beginning to intensely perspire in that suit, we went forward for about a half hour through cloud after cloud of interstellar gas-like material, what I call the quantum plenum. And the forward momentum, as we had been trained, the forward momentum stopped, and we were looking at the U.S. Supreme Court building, as we would later learn when we asked some of the program facilitators, some of the team leaders, in the year 2013. And then we quickly looked at it, tried to determine what was going on at that location, at the target, as it were, and then we were pulled back for another half hour. It was a pretty harrowing time probe. And I was taken off the stage. The suit was removed. I remember my boots were poured out. I don't know whether it was perspiration or water, because what they had done is they had placed us about 100 feet over the U.S. Supreme Court building on the Mall in Washington, D.C. in the year 2013. And at least on that timeline, it was underwater. But I must stress that the chronovisors were known to be capturing the residual signals of past events on multiple timelines. So I don't think that probe is determinative of that there will be a catastrophe, for example, in 2012 that will render the East Coast inundated by 2013.
Well, they kind of mixed it. They mixed it together or what? Were the timelines mixed together?
Well, they were mixed together at the level of our experience in the sense that we were being sent, for the most part, backward in time and witnessing a specific event. And we really didn't know Whether we were looking at the chronovisor actually inside the hologram, we did not know whether, in fact, that was determinative of a particular past. And certainly in that case, here we are, it's 2011. There could certainly be a catastrophe in 2012 that would create those kinds of conditions. But then again, some of the main causes, like global warming, clearly won't produce that by 2013. I'm speaking out because, you know, some of this intelligence that was derived from these kinds of probes clearly has been used for contingency planning of a very expensive nature by the U.S. government. We have secretly spent trillions of dollars building a continuity of government hub in the American Southwest, in the Four Corners area. And I hasten to add that that contingency planning may have been for future events that never occur. And that's a tremendous boondoggle. That's a tremendous unnecessary expense of trillions of dollars of our tax money. If in fact those kinds of that kind of catastrophe planning has fomented as a result of intelligence findings that are not valid, because the chronovisors have been sampling both the future on our timeline and then the future on adjacent timelines.
Is it accurate?
I think in that sense, chronovision among many time travel technologies that were fully operational by 1970. Cannot be viewed as dispositive of what is going to happen on our timeline. Teleportation is another matter, because with teleportation, you're jumping forward or backward in time on your timeline, just like going through adjacent rooms in a building. And in that sense, I think we can see why, for example, they were able to predict the identity of future presidents, not with chronovision per se, but clearly by teleporting people to the future and determining who was president.
At what was the latest point where you saw the equipment? 71, or have you seen it since?
Well, we were, 72 in terms of the large chronovisors where they were generating a hologram.
But you haven't seen it in 30, 40 years.
No. And in fact, these technologies may have been shelved. They may be hidden in some lockbox somewhere in the Pentagon, a la, Indiana Jones. I have no evidence that the program ended when I left it officially in 1972. There were later activities that I was brought into in which some of the technologies were used for specific purposes, but I was pretty much out of the program as a child by the end of the summer of 1972. I haven't seen the technology since then, so that's really something that I think that the next president should commission the Office of Management and Budget to go find the answer to. Were these technologies shelved? Were they brought more deeply into the intelligence community? Is there a building somewhere in the suburbs of Virginia where this kind of surveillance is going on, not using facial recognition systems and these more rudimentary approaches, but actually chronovision to capture somebody doing something in the past or future as it would appear in real time?
But like the UFO phenomenon, as presidents try to find out and unravel what might be going on, they get stonewalled. They don't get told what's really going on. So I would guess in this particular case, it would be the same thing.
Well, we do have some clues that chronovision did persist and was implemented as a permanent part of the U.S. intelligence community. I would just cite some of the strange facts of 9/11. For example, President Bush's statement at the time, 24 hours before he would have been able to see such images conventionally, that he had seen the first plane crash into the first tower. That film footage wasn't available until a day later. So unless he misspoke, that may indicate that he had some sort of console, perhaps even in his limousine, in the presidential limousine, in which technicians could pull up the event non-locally and show the president what happened. I don't think that's necessarily a bad idea. You know, as Secretary Rumsfeld said, we know what we know, we know what we don't know, but we don't know what we don't know. So I think, I think that a country as great as ours, and with our basic principles politically, I don't think it's a bad thing necessarily that our government is in possession of such technology, because at a minimum, it can afford the government the opportunity to make better decisions, the decisions that affect our well-being in the future, for example. The problem is that the technology has remained secret, so how it's used in other ways is something that we not only cannot know about, but not control for as a self-governing people. And I'm deeply disturbed by that prospect.
Might other governments have this technology?
By now, I would say yes, because when I was serving on Project Pegasus as a child, I was told several times by my late father and others that we were really only about 2 years ahead of the former Soviet Union. So if there's been any continuity of the Soviet program, that presumably, for example, the Russian government may be in possession of some of these time travel technologies. That may explain the famous story of the Russian diplomat at the dinner party in the early 90s informing the guests that the United States would have an African-American president named Barack. So there's an indication that another government was in possession of information from the future, which can only, at that level of specificity, can only be gathered with time travel technologies.
How far do you think they've gone into the future? You said you were around 2013. Have they gone further than that?
I would presume that if they're still utilizing the technology, they've gone into the far future with Chronovision. Using teleportation, the farthest I went forward in time was to the year 2045, and then we teleported back. That was via a Stargate device that was located at the Cerritos Cultural Center in New Mexico. But I have really no idea how far they've extended the envelope of knowing what the future might hold on different timelines with Chronovision. And if you think about it, this is really something that could work a revolution in education. Imagine school children studying American history, having the opportunity to go to a museum and or library and not just see a painting from the era during which the Constitution was framed.
Actually see history being unfolded right before your eyes.
Yeah, seeing the signing of the U.S. Constitution, not just reading about it. So I'm optimistic that if we do the right thing and disclose this technology and create the proper kind of public-private agency to control access to the images so as to preserve the privacy of everybody, that we can utilize it for a very formative and constructive purpose, which would be the opportunity to literally see the past as it really happened.
Well, these holographic images, Andrew, could you actually see George Washington, Benjamin Franklin? You can point them out?
In fact, the technician pointed both of them out on the screen. It was only at that type of device was only an 8-inch screen, an 8-inch circular screen with this kinescope-like scene or screen, dull tones, a little bit of green and gray tones. And that apparently was allowing them to see what they were filming on a 16-millimeter film stock. But the technician pointed to Washington, who I had some difficulty making out. I think that George Washington was thinner and possibly a smaller human being than he was depicted in the Auguste renderings of him that were sort of depicting him as a Roman god. I think he was a more diminutive person than that. Benjamin Franklin, however, I could readily make out. He was about twice as large as anybody in the room.
Pretty robust.
He was a large individual, large domed forehead. He was sitting on a sofa that had been placed about 10 feet in front of Washington, standing on the dais. And then to his right, the other framers were sitting on sort of stiff-backed wooden chairs, and sort of looking over deferentially, observing the illustrious Benjamin Franklin.
Where would this equipment be hidden now?
I think it's probably been sequestered within the private councils of government, within the inner reaches of the U.S. intelligence community and military.
Just amazing.
That would be Washington, D.C., rural Virginia, suburban Virginia, and other federal facilities around the country and the world.
Why now, Andrew? Why are you talking out about this now?
Well, I think as I noted, I mean, this is clearly a powerful and disruptive technology. I know it exists because I not only saw past and future events by looking at the holograms that the chronovisors were generating, I stood inside them and accessed those events. I time traveled in a sort of a physio virtual way utilizing that device. Clearly, they hold tremendous potential for sparking the kind of revolution in education that I described. Imagine the fascination that students and the general public would have if we could look into the past like this as members of the general public. You could go, let's say, to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and go into a museum where the actual delivery of the Gettysburg Address by Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, that would be exciting. We'll be back. Andrew, we're going to take phone calls with you next. Remarkable story. Andrew's website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com.